But our next guest is here, Jake Decker, and Jake is the author of One Kid at a Time. And as I told you before, November is National Adoption Month, and 500,000 American children are in need of a forever home. Welcome to the show. Nice to have you on, Jake.
Thank you so much, Catherine, and it's such a pleasure to be with you this morning.
It's great to have you. Okay, One Kid at a Time, and I have to read the title of the book, A Single Dad, A Boy in Foster Care, and an Adoption. And you have quite a story. I read it a couple days ago. It was a page-turner, kind of. And also a tearjerker. So let's start with you and Danny.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks, of course, for reading the book. You know, it's kind of funny. It is kind of a page turner. It's a real story, and you know, I was as curious as anyone else when I was living it, wondering how it was going to transpire and turn out. But you know, like so often when we make choices in life to do things like adoption, or I think things that are callings, you know, from the heart that we feel we should do, we don't know how it's going to turn out. And for me, the decision to adopt Danny, on really every measure that I would look at life choices, has been the best decision I've ever made.
Well, that's great. That's the ending of the story. That's the best decision, and it is a great story. So let's take it back a ways, because you yourself, I mean, you grew up, you had some of your own troubles, your own problems, and you discuss that in the book, but also you had, you were a gay man, a successful man, you had a partner, and you and your partner had decided in the beginning, which I think is, I don't know if it's true of a lot of people, you know, you thought you wanted to adopt a baby, a new baby, an infant. Let's start with that, because that obviously changed, you know.
I think, Catherine, that many couples or single people, those who choose to adopt, were just kind of conditioned to think that, well, I need an infant. And, you know, that's understandable. We live in a society where, you know, there are baby showers, and we're used to seeing little babies in cribs, and we sort of have, you know, imagine we'll get to see a first step and a first word, and, you know, many of us watch our siblings and friends and other folks in society, coworkers, have children, and that's just sort of what we're, you know, what I was conditioned, I think most of us are conditioned to think is going to happen. And I think underlying that was sort of a belief I had that, boy, I better start from scratch, because I don't want to get some kid that's messed up. You know, I need to raise them right. And so that was sort of where we went into it. And I went through a lot of opportunities to adopt, and they didn't quite work out. And then my partner and I pursued an international adoption. And then something happened that was unexpected. Our 8-year relationship ended. And I had to ask myself, do I want to still have an infant, or a very young child, about a 2-year-old actually, as a single parent? And I came to the conclusion that the answer was no, which was kind of a shock to me, because I'd wanted this baby and we'd worked so hard. And then I kept hearing about this 10-year-old kid, and the more I thought with it, on the one hand, the more uncomfortable I became with the idea, but on the other hand, it really felt like I need to pursue this.
But I have to ask you, Jake, because in the book you are, as you describe, you know, the professionals that you're associated with, and maybe I interpreted it wrong, but as a social worker, I'm really curious, there were a lot of social workers in the book. Were they putting, I kind of got the feeling that maybe one or two of them was kind of putting pressure on you. You know, they had this kid who was a difficult kid, psychologically, physical problem, all kinds of problems as a result of the abuse he had had with his own parents and his grandparents, that they were somewhat pressuring you or trying to get you to adopt this kid, and, you know, you were kind of not quite sure you wanted to do that.
No, you didn't get that wrong. I think in the book it felt, I think I described in One Kid at a Time that it felt like I was being encouraged to get a 10-year-old Buick at times. Yeah, I mean, now I need to clarify this. The phrase social worker applies to many people in the book, and there was a gamut of different people. One of the finest social workers, to my mind, in the book was a woman who was kind of reluctant for me to have him, because she was really concerned that I couldn't handle Danny and that he would get disappointed again. And over time, she was the one I really came to respect and trust. There were some others who, while I'm sure are well-meaning, are under a lot of pressure to get legally free kids out of the foster care system, get them adopted, and I was like the knight in shining armor showing up, because the reality was no one was interested in this kid. In the state I'm at, they have a definition in their terms called a thrown-away kid, and right there in the state manual, and that's what he was defined as. This is a kid that they don't say he's unadoptable, but they do say that nobody seems to want him, and we're really going to have to market him, you know, through the internet and through social workers and through things, because he's got a lot of issues. And so they were excited that somebody with my, quote, qualifications appeared interested.
What state are you talking about?
In Washington.
In Washington State.
Yeah, Washington State. Yeah.
Just so listeners know where we're talking
about. So I'm from Washington State, although I've come to learn that my experience, I certainly don't want to pick on Washington per se. I think that many of the problems you see with the foster care system and adoption are really more driven by federal policies and federal law and tend to apply to most states.
Yeah, but each state has its own specific laws, right? Statutes?
Absolutely. I think the reason that there's some similarities, of course, is a lot of the funding comes from the federal government, and so policies tend to take place that match those funding mechanisms.
So you talk about it as marketing a kid. I mean, as you say, marketing this kid on the internet and trying to get him out of, getting him out of foster care is a positive thing. Can we talk, because we do have time, the foster care system itself.
I came at it with no experience with it. I mean, I knew foster care existed. Well, that's not quite true. I mean, you've read One Kid at a Time, so you know that when I was a kid, I had a host of my own issues. I was raised by good, decent, loving parents. My dad was a professor. My mom was a teacher. And yet, despite that, I kind of did all the things that you hope your kids won't do. There was drugs, refusing to live at home, outrageous behaviors. And so at 15, I refused to live at home and ended up in a group home for about 6 or 7 months. And I was there the first weekend, and I called home and said, "Hey, listen, I think I made a mistake." And the therapist said, "Leave him there a while." So I had a little bit of my own experience of living in a group home, but really, other than that, I didn't know anything about the foster care system other than it existed, and I sort of naively thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if I did that someday or helped some kids? But what I found when I got into the system is that I believe it's fundamentally broken. I believe it's repairable, and I don't really believe anyone's at fault. But if we look at kids and numbers and statistics, we have roughly 500,000 U.S. kids in foster care, approximately 100,000 legally free, and we spend $25 billion federal and state dollars on these kids. And yet study after study, whether it's done by University of Chicago or it's anecdotal, tells us that in many, many cases, the outcomes are abysmal, particularly for older kids that age out. I mean, statistic after statistic talks about how they're at higher risk for unwanted pregnancies, going to jail, not being able to function in society. One that gets me, Catherine, is less than 3% of kids that age out of foster care manage to complete college, yet there's all these resources to help them do it. It's mind-boggling. And so...
you've stated the problem and stated right. It really well, unfortunately, but so what's the alternative? What can we do, or do you have any ideas? I mean, now that you've obviously been involved with the foster care system with Danny, what can we do differently? Are there alternatives?
Well, I think there definitely are. If I were magically blessed to be the czar of foster care, let's say there was a federal or state, you know, the head of the foster care secretary or something, I think the first thing I would do is recognize it's, and many people recognize this, it's a bigger problem than any one perspective is going to fix. And so the first thing I would do is gather people who I think about both common sense and experience to try to create a better system, because I know that sounds simple, but I think what we have now is a system that's just sort of morphed into this thing. I don't think it's designed so much as, you know, there's some crisis somewhere, so we throw a law at it to try to protect a kid, and that's fine. Now there's a new requirement for social workers, a new thing. Then another situation arises, and we have another crisis. And so what we've got is a system where so many of the resources just generate paperwork. I remember I was at the Holocaust Museum in D.C., and they have a thing you walk through, and you see all the shoes piled up of the people that didn't survive that. And I thought about, because I was a CASA as well, all the files of all these kids. I mean, these kids that are older in foster care have inches, feet in many cases, of files. Sometimes the files are so big they have to push them through the department on those dishwasher carts like you see in restaurants. You can't carry them all. And yet, most folks can't even read them or have access to them, and so much time is spent creating files, and the state social workers are required to do it, and that's where so many of the resources go, is just creating paperwork that no one really reads.
So what we have to do is kind of like, really, it almost sounds like you're saying start over again. I mean, we have all the, like you say, the paperwork, the time, the money, time spent, money spent, which really isn't spent helping the children. It's just spent on this, office work, I guess, is what you call it, but it's that social workers are wasting their time. So, how do you state? Let's say in Washington State, for example, you know, how would you revamp that? It seems almost impossible. It's taken on a life of its own, the foster care system.
It does seem almost impossible or insurmountable, but I don't think it is. I think if we can look at it with fresh eyes, I think it was Einstein that said the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. So we have to come at it from a different perspective. And I really think it's possible because the resources are there. But it would take, I think initially what you'd have to do is sort of run a parallel system. You don't want to throw away the system you have because you need something there. So I would start, for example, I might take legally free kids and say, all right, we're going to treat this group differently now. They're legally free. It's different than when you're working toward unification. And how can we, using a system that puts more resources into them, figure out a way to help these kids grow up to be independent adults that can function in society? And I think that's probably where I'd start. And with a goal that I think almost everyone could agree on, that a high percentage of the financial and human resources are in direct services to the kids. And so, I mean, I'd love to see 80% of the human and financial resources go into direct services to the kids. My own guess, it's hard to tell, but my own guess is it's probably somewhere around 30% goes into direct services, and probably around 70% gets consumed with policy and bureaucracy that's just sort of grown up around this unwieldy system.
Yeah, and we're talking about our children, and we're talking about our future. And, in reading your book, and I'm thinking, just the horrific situation that your son Danny went through with his, and I mentioned it before, but his parents, his grandparents, foster care, I mean, just such horrific abuse. And I guess his experience is not unique, unfortunately, or it's...
That's the sad part, Catherine. If his experience was unique, I could accept it better. The problem is, both as a CASA later and in talking to other people, I started to recognize how common his situation really is. And that's what really inspired me to write the book and to want to give a lot of my time toward advocating for a better system, because I know we can do better. No one would create this system the way it is. And the great news is as a society, most people get that we want to help our kids, and the resources, I think, are already there. I mean, you know, we're averaging spending around $60,000 per kid a year that are in foster care if you look at the total spending. So it's, you know, it's not like so many concerns we have in social work where there isn't any funding available. The funding's already there.
So, okay, now we have November is National Adoption Month. about, are you, what is that, I mean, we have national everything every month, whatever it is.
Yeah, right.
How is this helpful? Is this awareness? I mean, obviously, I think it is. Your book, you're on the radio, and I assume you'll be on other radio shows and television and stuff, and sort of getting the word out there about what really is going on in our foster care system, because I don't think that many people necessarily know that, and so I think that's why your book is so important, to get it out there. And, and by the way, I didn't even mention, it is, what was it? It was number one on number one customer rated book.
I'm a number two customer rated in the adoption category, and number one in fatherhood, which ain't bad for a single gay dad.
I think it's congratulations. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. Do you get any flack because you're a gay dad or a gay father? Or what about the laws? Are there laws in some, I mean, like these horrific laws that a gay couple can't adopt kids? I mean, is that state?
Yeah, those are still out there. In fact, I just have an op-ed piece that's coming out in The Advocate, such a large national circulation about that. There are several states that if you're gay, the state has determined they'd rather leave a child in foster care than place it with you. That's true. And I think that's totally lacking in any common sense. My story and many others prove that what makes a good parent isn't sexuality. It's a desire to protect, love, and take care of a child.
Yeah, exactly. And whoever that person is, whatever age, whatever, I mean, it's just... But
Catherine, it's getting better.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to defend the states that have these laws in place, but, you know, people are raised certain ways, and they have their fears, and they have their beliefs, and maybe I'm just too optimistic, but I have seen so much progress and so much growth in the decades I've been alive that I do think, generally, with some setbacks, we're headed in the right direction in many of these areas.
Yeah, I agree with you. We are headed in the right direction. We're doing the right thing, and it takes time. What is cultural lag? Enact certain laws, good laws, and go in the right direction, and then it takes time for people's attitudes to change. And
it does, and often once you talk to these people in dialogue, they're well-meaning and they have their beliefs, and in probably in most cases, if they understood Danny's background, the fact nobody wanted him, and the fact that I did, most people would support that. So, you know, I do think that's getting better, but sure, I've hit some flack, but I'm very pleased that piece of it is getting better, and I think you're also right that so many people don't understand, even though it's National Adoption Month, how many children are in care in the United States waiting to be adopted. There's around 100,000, and if I could communicate almost anything out of my story with Danny, it's that older children are adoptable too. I mean, I cannot imagine loving a child anymore if I'd had him since birth. And did it happen overnight? No, it took some months for me, maybe even a year. But I've got a great relationship, a fantastic son. And, you know, we started when he was 10 years old with a host of issues. Can I guarantee it would work every time? No. But there's no guarantees in parenting anyway.
Well, there are no. I have three boys. There are no guarantees.
Right.
Yes, and it's always ongoing. I mean, they're in their 20s and 30s, and it's a lifelong process. There's no question about that. You haven't gotten there yet.
You're scaring me. I have a 14.
You will do it. You're doing it, and you just keep on going. And speaking of that, okay, let's talk. You know, specifically, what were some of the issues? Some of the difficulties that you've had, you know, that's what we want to talk about. Let's be specific.
Yeah, well, when I first had him, he was so consumed with anxiety that it was difficult for me to sit in a room with him. He was so anxious about everything. He lied really constantly, and I grew to recognize his lies were just out of habit and trying to get rid of anxiety, but he lied constantly. He took things that weren't his. He constantly talked, moved. He was constantly moving and fidgeting. There were food hoarding behaviors. He was on a bunch of psychotropic medications. He'd been suspended from school. I don't think it was nine or 11 times in fourth grade, and we were just starting fifth grade. And so those were some of the, there weren't good hygiene habits. So those were some of the things that I was starting with.
So, I mean, those are pretty big issues, and obviously you are, you know, more than capable of handling it. But do you think also some of your, like, your stuff that you went through when you were in high school was probably helpful? You had a good understanding besides being, you know, an intelligent.
So. Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I would say I wasn't on paper capable of handling it all, and maybe it was a sick cockiness on my part or a bizarre willingness, but I decided to try, and I think my own experiences, along with I am over two decades clean and sober in 12-step programs, and I've worked with a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of things. You can't sit in 12-step meetings with, you know, more than 20 years clean and work with people and not see a broad range of society. And so one thing that time in 12-step programs has taught me is that miracles happen, people change, and I think I was more hopeful than many folks might be because I've seen people that were destined for death or prison or homelessness become, you know, teachers and productive members of society.
So you've had a lot of experience. I mean, and obviously that stood you in good stead with Danny, but did you ever feel like giving up sometimes? I mean, honestly, like, I want to take him back. I can't handle this.
Are you kidding? Of course. I remember one day, it was about 3 months into it, laying down on my bed and just crying and feeling I can't do it. And you know, the funny thing, Catherine, is I didn't feel like taking him back. I just knew I couldn't do it. And I'm like, how did I find myself at this point? I've listened to my heart. I've tried to balance that with my mind. I felt this was a calling and I'm doing it, yet it's not working. And you know, I sat with that feeling, and then the next day I got up and made him breakfast, and there was a new day. It passed.
And I think, you know, as a parent, it happens when your kids aren't adopted as well. And,
you can't take them back in that case.
Yeah, and you can't take them back, and you want to take them back. I was just talking to a girlfriend of mine about that the other day, you know, kind of reminiscing about when the boys were on teenagers. But anyway, you didn't take them back. And what's kind of the most, I mean, I don't know if you can really answer this, but let's talk about some of the rewarding times. I mean, like those moments, like this is great. I'm so glad that I did this, or, you know, not just the challenges, but the good stuff.
Well, I believe that deep within the human psyche, just like we have an instinct for social connection, intimacy, and security, that we have an instinct for meaning, that we come to a point in our development where we want our lives to have meaning, that in some way, in some fashion, it's important that we matter in ways that really matter. And for me, I didn't realize this right away, being Danny's dad has filled my life with challenges and loss of many freedoms, but it is completely added incredible meaning to my life. I don't question if my life matters. I've got a young man up there who totally understands that he has a dad, and this is the most meaningful thing in the world to him. I traded some of my wants and desires, and I had a nice life and vacation homes and business class airfare and lots of the things that, you know, we're conditioned to think will make you happy, and they did make me happy at times, no question. However, they didn't bring meaning to my life, and I traded that. I traded those wants to meet his deepest needs, and I believe that's always a good choice. When we're exchanging wants for authentic needs, I think to that part of us that matters most, it's an incredibly wise trade, and that's what I did. And so, you know, as hard as some of my days are, I'm living a life I chose that I think is filled with meaning, and I feel more connected to the things that matter most.
How old is Danny now?
He's 14, but he'd tell you almost 15, because he keeps reminding me at 15 he can get a learner's permit in this state.
Well, but good luck with that. That's
Thank
always,
you.
That's another challenge. But, okay, so he's 14 now. He has two biological sisters, is that right?
That is absolutely right, yeah.
Now, does he maintain contact with them, or how does
that
work?
Oh, yeah, they've both moved up here. They live in our town. They probably spend 5 nights a month with us, spending the night, and they've almost become de facto daughters. I see them all the time. They don't have parents in their lives either, and they both aged out of the foster care system, so I've helped them with the various things you have to do as a young adult. And so, you know, the girls tell me that I didn't just adopt him, that I've adopted all of them.
Well, Well, it sounds like you did. That they're right about that. You have a whole family there, which...
Well, I can tell you that when it comes to, you know, the holidays coming up, yeah, we'll all be sitting around the table looking at each other for sure.
What about your role in the community? How do people see you? I mean, you and, you know, how supportive is the school, for instance, Danny's or was or is, or, you know, and also the people in the county, I don't know how big your community is, but...
The school's been fantastic. I've just been extraordinarily fortunate there. The school has just been great, and it's a small rural school, but we've just had, one of the miracles has been we've just had the perfect teachers and administrators, so it's been fantastic. In the community, I was a CASA in this community, and I was active. CASA is a guardian ad litem, or a court-appointed special advocate that advocates for children in court, and I've been effective in that. However, I think we're not a huge community. It's a county of about 200,000 people. The courts and the local state agencies don't particularly care for really strong, well-informed advocates. So I have to choose my battles, and I don't, you know, take everything to the wire. You can't do that and get things done. But so, as far as Danny goes, the local parents and things have been very supportive. I mean, there's lots of single parents around, and I think when people know the story, they feel a lot of compassion toward him and want to support him. But at this point, we keep a pretty low profile. It's not that we're hiding it, but it's something that happened, but it's not a day-to-day issue so much as it was 3 or 4 years ago.
So you blended into the community, as most of us do after a while. I mean...
Exactly. I was at an IEP meeting for him, an individual education plan at his school, for anyone who doesn't know that, a couple weeks ago. And he's on an IEP for emotional behavioral disturbance. And so it's the annual meeting, and the facilitator said to the vice principal, well, how have things been? And he kind of shrugged and said, listen, he's not even on my radar. I haven't seen any problem all year. And you know, and that's really, he goes, this is a typical active 14-year-old freshman boy.
Well, it's a great ending. I mean, it's not the ending, but to the story. But what would you say, what kind of advice would you give to single individuals who want to adopt, or couples, and is there anyone who would be more suited to the challenge? I mean, you obviously were, I don't want to say necessarily special, but you were really suited and an appropriate man to adopt this Danny, who had a lot of problems and troubles. And are there people who you would say, don't do it, like you need to, and what should they be thinking about?
Absolutely. I think there are people who definitely shouldn't do it. I think if someone feels a call to parenting, there's many ways to do that, and it doesn't always involve having children in your home. There's a lot of adults that need parenting, too. So I think that the advice I would give someone is, if you feel you should do this, to take slow steps and to try not to make too many judgments on a daily basis. Like, several times I decided I couldn't do it and I would take Danny back. But I'd made a decision, if I decided that, I'd wait 3 days. Just no matter what, you know. And so that always passed. And so I had to learn not to make hasty decisions or snap decisions in the moment. I guess you could say I had to learn some maturity about it. So I would encourage people to try to be mature about it and get as many friends, therapists, if you have in your circle of friends, other, you know, well-meaning folks who will help you, and other parents, to be a web of support. I should have talked about this more. I had a huge, huge web of support. This took a village. This is not just me. There are so many close friends that have helped this happen, and that probably that would be the single most important thing I'd say. Don't do it alone. Even though you're alone, get help from others, and be honest. Talk about the fact that, you know, that this kid is driving you nuts and you don't know if you can do it, and sometimes they say something and you feel like slapping them. That's okay. It's okay to feel that way, but you know, you don't want to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point, obviously. It does take a village, and I know in the book you mentioned that when you went to see Danny, I don't know if it was the first time, I can't remember, but your mother went with you, so you had your own support, your own family support from your family of origin. Your mom was there, so I would imagine that made a huge difference.
It made a huge difference. I involved friends and family from the very beginning, and And I should say that some of them were not too inclined to me doing this. I was told by someone I'm very close to that of all the dumb things you've ever done, this is the worst decision you've ever made.
How wrong they were.
And I was angry about it for a while, but I realized, Catherine, that was rooted in their desire to worry about me. And so the other thing I guess I would advise people is, for me, my brain all along said this idea that you can help a troubled 10-year-old with all these problems is crazy. But my heart kept saying, this is the right thing for you. And so what I did was, and what I kept telling my brain is, all right, if you're right, I won't do it. But we're going to keep putting one step in front of the other and see how it works out. Like, don't make a plan. Just do it and see how it unfolds. Because the reality is, if you're going to adopt a child from foster care, I think every state requires they live with you for at least 6 months prior to the adoption being finalized.
Jake, what about, and I don't know if you can address this or not, but what about families that, I mean, you didn't have any other children, so you could focus all your energy, all your attention, all of it on to Danny. But what about couples or individuals who have other children in the family? I mean, is it more risky? I mean, let's say you have one or two other children and then you introduce an older child with a lot of issues into the family. That's another challenge. Would you recommend that? Or
you know, Catherine, I am not wise enough to give you any input on that. It sounds difficult to me. I know that just integrating Danny into my extended family in terms of how his cousins reacted as they saw his relationship with their uncle, I am certain it would be a challenge, and I would, you know, I was asked to take other kids after I took Danny because the state saw this was going so well, and they have these kids they want to place, and I said no to every one of them. I didn't even consider meeting them, and it's not that I didn't care about them, but one of the reasons I made the title One Kid at a Time is I recognized for me that was all I could do. Now, could it have been two kids at a time? Absolutely. But once I made the decision for Danny to be his dad, I was clear that was all I could do. I was at the limit of my resources.
Yeah. Well, you seem to be, I mean, after talking to you for this half hour, you seem to be obviously a person who has a good understanding of what you're able to do, what you're capable of, and your own limitations. And I guess that's what you're saying. Each person has to just examine, you know, what they are capable of and what they can do and make a good choice. I want to mention that we have to say goodbye, but I want to mention, I mean, it's a great thing, this One Kid at a Time, a single dad, a boy in foster care, and an adoption, Jake Decker. And Jake, you have a website also that we can go to?
I do, and if people are interested in resources, I maintain about 40 or 50 links for a variety of topics, and the website is jakedecker.com, and there's links about the book and so on and so forth, but it's a real nice collection of resources that I update regularly there.
Great. It's been great having you on the show, and obviously the best to both you and Danny. You're a great dad. He's a lucky guy.
To you, too, and your three boys, and, you know, Saturday the 17th is National Adoption Day, and I appreciate you putting a face on the fact that we have a lot of kids out there that need to be adopted that don't necessarily look like little kids.
Great. Have a great day. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to The Social Workers, and it's the Social Workers Radio Talk Show. I'm your social worker with a microphone, Catherine Zox, WCDB-FM, University at Albany, with Noah Bundy. I think he's been giving me the eye. It's time to say goodbye. And I hope you had a great week. We'll see you next Thursday.